3, hello and welcome to A Woman's Wit, Wisdom and Pratfalls with me, author Joan Ellis. It's the first run in my new show, so please be gentle with me. I'm going to be chatting to a host of guests, including writers and poets and celebrity islanders. Today we've got Jan Toms, the acclaimed author, a very prolific writer, and we're going to be talking about keeping up with the times. So that's going to take us here, there and everywhere, and we're going to have a laugh. So if you want to ring in and chat to us, we'd love to hear from you. And hello, Jan.
Hello, Joan. It's very kind of you to invite me along. Wit, wisdom and something else you
Pratfalls,
said.
Pratfalls, yeah.
Oh, right.
Well, it's kind of celebrating life, you know, our wonderfulness, our wit, our humour, and those banana skin moments, you know, which we've all had where we try and impress someone and then we fall flat on our face, probably like I'm going to do today.
Yeah,
so anybody listening, as long as you know you're in the company of a complete fool, then we're going to be all right. But it's those, isn't it, that we can all think, oh, yes, I've done that. You know,
yes,
I've tried to
definitely.
Impress. And,
definitely.
Yeah. So it's everything and anything, like I said. But I'd really like to talk a lot about your work and your history. So fire away.
Well, I'm a very fortunate person because I've had, I think in some ways, it feels like a charmed life. I was born on the Isle of Wight. I have generations on all sides of my family were all on the island because they weren't very adventurous. So I think I actually broke the mould by deciding to go and work on the main, first of all on the mainland, mm-hmm. and then to really go a long way. And I went to work in the Foreign Office and abroad.
Oh, wow.
So this was a bit different from my family, who were all quite happy to stay here and have, you know, very good, fulfilled lives.
So presumably you won't be disclosing any official secrets today, though, Jan.
Oh, I can't talk about it.
So did you presume, you must have signed the official secrets agreement?
Yes, that was, you know, that was a requirement.
Yeah, and so even after so many years have elapsed, you can't say anything, you can't tell us anything, let us in on a state secret?
The only trouble is this was now 50 years ago, and I don't think those state secrets would actually change the world history. No, there aren't any.
So was that time an inspiration for any of your novels?
Do you know, funnily enough, I don't think it was. I mean, I went to Geneva when I was 21, and I think you're so full of yourself at that age.
Yes. And, well, you know it all, don't you?
Oh, you do indeed. And here's me going off with, you know, with my luggage and arriving and staying in a posh hotel, working at the United Nations building, you know, tripping along and feeling full of your own importance. I didn't think about writing at that stage at all.
So what were you what was your role there?
I was what was called a B6 officer, which was fairly lowly, and it was sort of part clerical work, part cipher work as well, which was, I didn't understand how it worked.
So code breaking?
Well, yes, but I didn't know how it worked.
Jan, you're a dark horse, I had no idea.
No, there, you see, yes.
Because that was in the days, I suppose, before terrorism, wasn't it? I mean,
it was
a very different time.
It was the Cold War. Mm. It was, in fact, you know, it was very serious times. And in some ways, I don't think I realised just what was going on. Because there was a delegation in Geneva of Russians and Americans and French and British, you know, high-level meetings, really trying to stop a nuclear war ever happening.
Goodness me.
But I was much more
so much the same as it is now, really.
Well, this is the tragic thing that nothing has really
nobody
changed.
Learns, no, do they?
Just
nobody
the
learns.
Same situation, really. Suspicion and, you know,
ruled by
projecting
fear.
Onto other people all these dreadful things that we do ourselves as well. So yes, a silly world in some ways.
And then you, I think you told me you fell in love. And that brought you back to the island.
Oh dear.
That little thing called love.
I fell in love actually when I was 15. And so this was on the Isle of Wight. And the object of my affection was a young Nigerian student who was spending the Easter holidays here.
On the island?
Yes.
I love that.
And in the 1950s, most people on the Isle of Wight wouldn't have seen a black person at all.
No.
Hard as it, you know, is now to believe. You didn't see black people on, well, there wasn't television even in the 1950s. Our 50s, my goodness, going back thinking that how long ago that all was. But anyway, I fell in love, and against all the odds, I wasn't going to let anything get in the way of the object of my desire.
Good for you.
And I mean, sadly, long term, it didn't work out very well. But I've got.
Did you marry?
Yes, we did. Yes, and I've got a beautiful son. And I hate to think how old he is, because I realise how old I am.
Oh, hello. So you married here on the island, presumably?
Yes, yes, yes. It was a quiet affair.
And you've remarried now. And you were telling me your husband does all the cooking and the housework and lets you write in your ivory tower. Lucky you.
Yes, my second husband is an absolute... In fact, I think men hate him because he does all the things that a woman would love a husband to do. You know, lots of domestic things and being there and all the wonderful things that, you know, you want in life.
It makes such a difference if you've got someone to support you. When
it certainly
particularly
does.
As a writer, because it's such an insular occupation, isn't it?
And time runs away with you.
Yeah.
And if someone's going to sort of say, oi, where's my dinner? You know, that's not conducive.
Exactly, no, because you can be there for hours at the keyboard, can't you? Hours on end.
And yes, indeed.
Makes you very antisocial.
It is, really, yes, yes.
So have you had those, you must have had one of those moments, Jan, please tell me, because you seem so serene and perfect, and I've always admired you, you know, and came to the island in your work. But you must have had a pratfall moment. You must have had a banana skin moment.
Oh, goodness. I think I'm always putting my foot in it. And there is that feeling of, you know, sometimes, here I am, you know, what do people really think of me? You know, I think I know who I am.
Yes.
But sometimes there's a sort of certain distance. You meet somebody and you start to think, well, it must be me. And then you realise sometimes, well, it's them, because perhaps they're a bit shy. They don't quite know what to make of you.
Yes, it is that thing to see ourselves as others see us, isn't
yes,
it?
Yes, indeed, yes.
It's like when I've heard back some of the recordings on the radio, and I think, oh, that sound okay. And then I hear it, and I think, no, you don't. You sound like Pattle for EastEnders, you know, it's just awful.
You don't. You've actually got a very nice voice.
Not sure.
No. I do have the same trouble when I hear myself. I think, who is that person? Because having been born here, you know, all my family were all real Isle of Wighters, complete with our local dialect. I think, well, why haven't I got that dialect? And I know the reason is actually because my mother, when she was 7, was taken to Wales because my grandfather left the island to find work in the on the railways. And so, of course, you know, her formative years really meant that she ended up with a different accent. And so, of course, you spend your time with your mother. So I also inherited, you know, part of her accent.
Yes.
And not this lovely pure Isle of Wight accent I wish I had.
But you can occasionally still hear it, don't you? Which is lovely when you do.
Oh, it is. It's precious these days.
Very much so.
Yes.
Very much. Yeah. No,
yes.
It's a lovely accent.
Yes.
So what would you like to read to us first? Because I know you've brought some samples of your writing in.
Well, I thought, given... the weather, and it's not very nice, I try and find something amusing, which I hope it's amusing.
It's always good.
But I wrote a book about 3 or 4 years ago called The Isle of Wight Book of Days. And in fact, it has an entry for every day of the year about something that happened on the Isle of Wight.
Okay.
So I looked to see what happened on February the 26th.
Brilliant.
And I'll tell you what happened, then I'll read something to you about that event. In fact, on the 26th, February the 26th, 1949, the senior members of the Labour Party, people like Sir Stafford Cripps and Dr. Edith Summerskill, all these very important cabinet ministers, came down to the Isle of Wight and went to Shanklin Manor because they were planning the party conference.
Right.
And this party conference they planned was the only time the Labour Party have held a conference here on the Isle of Wight. In fact, I think it's the only political party that's actually held their conference here. But they came on that date, today's date, 1949, to hold their conference. So it took place at Easter. And afterwards, I've got a little report here of how things happened. And it says, excuse me, in February, the Labour Party conference chose to hold their annual conference for the first and only time on the Isle of Wight. The venue was Shanklin Manor, a house owned by the Workers' Travellers Association. Present were 60 members, including Prime Minister Clement Attlee, Sir Stafford Cripps, Dr. Edith Summerskill, Ernest Bevin, Aniron Bevan, and a youthful Harold Wilson. Local curiosity or even indifference turned to outrage when it was discovered that the delegates had consumed more than their permitted bacon ration. This, of course, is when it was rationing, of food course, rationing. Yeah. Before the bench were the managers of Cowes and Shanklin Co-ops, the manager of Shanklin Manor, and the executive of the WTA, the Workers' Travellers Association, all accused of flouting the food rationing order, 1948. Counsel for the hotel and the WTA explained that the offence had been a purely technical one, and then nobody had been buying bacon under the counter. A belief had arisen locally that delegates had been gorging themselves on bacon while it was unavailable to the local population. This was untrue. The Minister of Food himself had been present, as was the Chancellor of the Exchequer, who was vegetarian, and in addition, he had declined to accept an extra portion of cheese to which he was entitled. On April 13, the Western Morning News reported that a fine of £2 with £10 cost was imposed for each summons.
Aha. Goodness, bacon wars. Fancy that, gosh. You can't imagine that going back into rationing now, can you?
No, indeed. Gosh, no.
I mean, people would just be outraged if anything like that had to be brought in, wouldn't they? Because we've got so used to this easy come, you know, consumable giant packaging.
Yes, walk into any supermarket and you're overwhelmed by shelves of biscuits, you know.
And just down the every high street seems to just be a food outlet, a cafe or a, you know, a restaurant, doesn't
yes.
it? It never used to be like that when I was young. I mean, we never went anywhere anyway, but I remember my mum used to take me to the Pontefract Cafe, and I used to have a peach Melba.
Ooh.
Yeah, a peach. And of course, that was such a big deal. And the Lion's Corner House, do you remember those?
Oh, I do indeed.
With the nippies.
Yes.
And she used to have something sensible, but I used to have the brown bread and butter, and that's what I lived on. But it was such a treat, whereas now it's not really, is it? It's no big deal. People go out all the time.
There aren't really any treats, are there? Because everything is available
that's
to
right.
you.
That's right, yeah. So when you look forward to something like Christmas or lots of chocolate Easter, people just have that, like you say, the whole time.
Yes.
There was one time when goodness only knows how this happened, but we landed up at the Bunny Club. And I know, in Park Lane. I was only about six, and I think I'd been going on about wanting to go there, not knowing, obviously, what it was really all about. And I don't think my parents they couldn't have known what it was all about. And I just honestly thought it was something about rabbits, but it wasn't, was it? And I can remember us getting to these double doors in Park Lane in this big building, and then my father, mother and me, you know, this little five-year-old, being roundly turned round and ushered out down into the down the lift, you know, my father being apoplectic with rage when he saw, you know, what it was really all about, with these bunny girls doing the bunny dip. And I thought, that looks rather nice, you know, took quite fancy to the costume, but that was my brush with the Bunny Club, yeah. But inappropriate, honestly. The kind of life I've had.
Yes, I don't think any. Well, I think I had a very sheltered life until I actually, you know, grew up and left home.
But you probably had you must have had quite a baptism of fire joining the Foreign Office and being abroad straight from the island like that at such a young age.
The most powerful time really was actually just leaving the Isle of Wight and going up and living in London, because I was there for 3 years before I was old enough to go abroad. And so, you know, going to school on the Isle of Wight to working in the Foreign Office in Downing Street, I mean, it's just such a complete difference. We didn't have a telephone at home.
We didn't have a telephone at home. Just unthinkable now, isn't it? When we've all got one in our back pocket.
I was thinking that, you know, we didn't have a car. Our house didn't have hot running water. It was an outside toilet. I was thinking, you know, my dad never had a bank account, anything like that. So the first thing I had to do was get a bank account when I started work, because you got a salary that was paid in, you know. And, I mean, his life experience and mine... just so different.
Very different. Yes. Yeah, as each generation Yes. You know, we all think we're going to keep up, don't we? And then this moment comes where you think, no, actually, I just haven't got a clue about that. And please don't start trying to explain it, because that's just white noise you're making now, and I haven't got a clue.
Don't tell me that, because I don't want to hear.
Well, just do it for me. Thank you. Because I was up in, I mean, nothing as racy as what you were doing, Jan, or as important, indeed. But I worked in advertising in Soho. In the 80s.
That's a good place to work.
It was. And Knightsbridge, so and Canary Wharf. So I was up and around all these dives. My dad used to say, you know, you can't go and work in Soho. But it was fine. Mm. You know, it was a great place. And the best thing about it was they had these wonderful patisseries. Just fabulous.
Oh, yes.
You know, Patisserie Valerie, which of course is now a chain, but it was just the one off then. And part of my first book is actually set there, because I spent so much time in there eating croissants and drinking cappuccinos. And Maison Berthaud, which is a beautiful little French patisserie in the heart of Soho, and that's still there, still run by the two sisters.
Really nice, isn't it?
And they're featured in the book, and they've bought a copy, and it sits on their piano in there, which is really lovely.
Oh,
you know, it's kind of after the, like I say, the years and the, you know, the money I spent and the calories I consumed in there. It's really lovely to have the book there. But yeah, talking about keeping up with the times, I did a launch in Patisserie Valerie of IML By Me, which is, I suppose, it's kind of Mad Men meets Bridget Jones. It's about my life in advertising in the 80s. And the manager of Patisserie Valerie, he said, oh, Joan, would you come and do a launch? You know, I'd love to, it'd be great. So I said, yeah, sure. And he was going to put a lot of marketing behind it. Anyway, I turned up on the day, and he said, oh, I'm so sorry, I've just got back from holiday, I haven't had an opportunity to do anything. So I said, okay, no worries. And he said, but, you know, I still want you to sign, meet and greet the customers, and then do your talk in the evening. He said, and what we'll do, we'll stream it direct to our website. And he said, you can stream what you're doing direct to our website.
That sounds technical.
Well, honestly, Jan, I thought, what I should have said, you know, anybody with any sense would have said, I don't know what you're talking about, you know. And even if I did, I can't stream, sign, meet, greet and do a talk simultaneously. Yeah, that's what I should have said. I didn't say any of that. I just went, yeah, that'll be fine. I'll stream. Not having a clue. Not having a, you know. So I said, yeah, that's fine. Thinking, it's fine. He'll be on hand. He'll help me. No, with that, he snapped his briefcase shut, waved and left. And I said, but you'll be back later, won't you, when I do the talk? He said, no. He said, I live in Kent, I'm getting a train. Oh, please, no.
Me.
So I was just left there, and I did meet and greet. I sold some books, met some lovely people, signed some copies and did the talk. Took a few photos, Jan. That was about as far as I got. I took a few photos on the mobile, and I thought, well, that'll have to do, because that's all I'm capable of. And I thought, well, I'll send him those. So I emailed him those, and I thought, hopefully that will suffice. It can't be a patch on streaming, but it's going to have to do, because it's all I'm capable of. And the next day I was at a literary festival, and a friend who'd been to the talk, she texted me and said, oh, I was there last night, forgot my camera. Can you send me a picture of you and me at the event? And I said, yeah, sure. I thought, simplest thing, just copy her in on that email, forward that email to her that I sent to the manager of Pat Vells. So off it went. And then she buzzed back, texted me straight back and said, Joan, no pictures of me, but always lovely to get one of you in a pixie hat. I thought, no, no. So leapt back on my computer. I thought, what have I sent? Opened up all the attachments that I'd sent to her and the manager of Patisserie Valerie, the area manager. And there, sure enough, was one of me in a pixie hat. Actually taken at Thompson's Garden Centre, because one of those things where you stick your heads through and you're in a pixie hat. One of me in a pixie hat. One of my elderly mother, opening a Christmas present that clearly she didn't want to receive, judging by the look on her face. And thirdly, the cat mounting the turkey. So I had sent all the pictures of our rubbish Christmas. I just thought, how did I manage to do that? So you're talking about keeping up with the times. I mean, talk about Luddite. What a fool. Have I heard from the manager of Pat Vells ever again? No.
Really?
No, I sent a very nice apology, but he clearly thought, you know, I was just taking the mickey, which I wasn't. So if you're listening now, I'm so sorry. But like I say, you're just dealing with a bit of a fool.
Some people just don't have a sense of humour.
No. Well, you think you need it though, don't you?
Well, I think it's the only way to get through life, really.
Definitely, yes, have a laugh. Yes,
it really is.
Best medicine.
If you don't see the funny side of things, well, you know, life's going to be a very, you know, painful experience.
When you're trying to keep up and you can't, it's very difficult. And you've done something, so I think another thing, animals, they're timeless, aren't they?
They are.
You don't need to keep up with the times to love an animal and to get their love back.
No.
And I know you've done a book, haven't you? A very special book.
I did a long time ago. I was very lucky. I had an idea for writing a book, and I sent it to Shire Publications. And a lot of people remember those books, I think, with affection, because they were little A5 copies, and they were for about every subject under the sun. You could get a book on crochet hooks, a book on clay pipes, a book on dustbins. There was a book on everything. And I sent them my idea, and they came back and said, no, thanks, we're not interested. They said, in fact, the only thing we haven't done that we would like to is a book on animal graves and memorials.
Right.
And so, without thinking about it, I said, oh, I'll do it.
Yes, good girl. Always say yes. That's my motto.
Yes. And it was really such fun because, I mean, people, you know, have such a bond with the animals. I feel sorry for people who don't have that affinity with animals. I think it's sad for them, and of course often sad for the animals as well. But one thing really amused me, I wrote the introduction largely about the fact that do animals have souls? This mm-hmm. is the question that, you know, has been asked for a long time. And surprisingly, Queen Victoria and Lord Byron were absolutely in agreement that animals definitely had souls. And so I wrote, you know, a bit about what they thought and how they'd come to this conclusion and everything. And a long time later, I had something from the University of Northern Ireland asking me if it was possible to quote from my work for some you know, course that they were running. I thought, this is off the top of my head. I've written this, and now, you know, it's been used in some academic circles.
Wow, get
so
you.
You never know what you say, don't know who's listening.
No. So the graves, did you visit and go and visit the graves?
Well, I visited as many as I could, but the manager of Shire Publications at that time, he was a lovely man who went all over the country delivering things, and he would just say, I'm going up to Yorkshire tomorrow. Are there any graves up there you'd like me to photograph? Yeah. And so then he would go and do so.
Well, I've got to say, really sorry for this buzzing, but they're doing a lot of renovation work in the building next door. So I'm so sorry if you can hear this in the background. But Jan, going back to what you were saying, are there a lot on the Isle of Wight? Are there a lot of animal graves on the Isle of Wight?
There are quite a few. I didn't find as many as I would like to have done. There are some in Osborne House because Queen Victoria,
of course,
her dog's buried there, and in Barton Manor. I found a dog that was the pet of a lady called Lady Florence Dixie, who was one of these really very upper class, very aristocratic hunt and shoot and fishing ladies. Mm. And she used to come for the summer to the Isle of Wight with her family. She was really boyish. She should have been a boy, really. And she had her dog here, and sadly, he got run over by a train at Roxall Station.
Oh, gosh.
And she wrote a poem about it. And that set me to thinking about, who is this woman? And so, of course, I ended up by writing you know, articles and things about Lady Florence Dixie as well. She was amazing. She was the chairman of the Scottish Football Association. She decided she would wear men's clothes because they're much more comfortable and women should not wear the things they did. She got into trouble from Queen Victoria for turning up at a, I forgot what you call it, when, you know, they were introduced, the Debs.
Oh, yes, coming out.
Yes, and in fact, she turned up wearing all the wrong things, so she was castigated. And she was actually accused for causing John Brown's death.
Oh, really? What did she do? as in John Brown's body lies a mouldering in the grave?
Yes, yes.
Right, okay. What did she do?
There was a scandal that somebody apparently attacked her, some Fenians attacked her when she was at Windsor, and John Brown was sent out into the cold to sort something out and caught this chill from which he died.
Oh.
And so she definitely blamed Florence for causing his death. So she had a fairly
controversial life.
Very, yes.
So have you got any of those tales you'd like to share with us?
Not about that in particular. I did think of one or two things that might be of interest.
I'll tell you what, Jan, I'm going to go to an ad break now and hopefully they'll stop their drilling next door.
Well, they might do, that
yeah.
would be...
So we'll give that a whirl. It'll probably be complete silence during the ads and then they'll start up again when we start talking. But let's give it a whirl and see if that works.
Yes,
okay, back
crossed.
In a moment.
The Lunchtime Social, brought to you in association with White Fibre, providers of the fastest fibre optic broadband on the island. Call them on 01983 240 240. That's 01983 240 240.
This is Vectis Radio,
serving the Isle of Wight and beyond.
www.vectisradio.com.
Working with clay is great fun, and you can now give it a go. If you're aged between 11 and 19 years and live on the Isle of Wight, call the Key Arts box office on 822 490 now to book your place. Waves Pottery Workshop on Saturday the 5th of March from 10 a.m. to 2:30 p.m. is free and will give you the opportunity to spend a fun day in our pottery. Work will be glazed and ready to collect 2 weeks later. Waves Key Arts Youth Offer is funded through the Isle of Wight Council.
Betapack, everything your business needs. Office supplies, cleaning supplies, packaging, office furniture, catering supplies, first aid, printed carrier bags, tea and coffee machines, saving you time and money. Betapack. Check them out now, www.betapack.co.uk, or give them a call, 01983 721 100. Fast, free, next day delivery, island wide. Betapack.
Want to beat the NHS waiting times and be seen by an experienced physiotherapist? If you have an injury, ongoing pain, or just want some advice, contact Physiocare and Sports Injury Clinic today. We are the largest and oldest physiotherapy practice on the island, with three practices in Ryde, Bembridge and Cowes, and our aim is to see people within 48 hours. We're registered providers for all the major UK insurance companies. Let our enthusiastic team help you. Contact our friendly and knowledgeable practice manager, Rachel, on 01983 812 576 or by email manager@physio-care.com or on our website physio-care.com.
White Crystal is an Isle of Wight charity selling still and carbonated spring water products, flavoured and water coolers to fund care services, employment and life-enhancing opportunities for people with a range of disabilities. To see their fabulous wide range of products, go to www.whitecrystal.org.uk or call to place an order on 01983 520 128. That's 01983 520 128.
Weekend starts early. It's Wham Bam Alama time. Your 2 hour tonic of rock and roll. We're playing rockers, rollers, smoochers and doo-wop in that great era of music. So join me, the old boy, every Friday, 3 to 5 p.m. for a whole lot of shaking. Only on Vectis Radio. Goodness gracious, great walls of vinyl.
Stay social and get in touch. Give us a call on 01983 240 666.
Hello and
the
welcome
Lunchtime
back.
Social,
so, Jan, you said you had a couple of things you wanted to talk about, so fire away.
I've been sitting here thinking about the writing.
That's 01983 240 240.
The people like Tolstoy, who wrote War and Peace, wrote it all by hand. And I've just been reading a biography of Samuel Taylor Coleridge, and he was the most prolific writer. And I mean, he just produced volumes and volumes of work. And I think now we often talk about the fact that the writing, you know, there's too much paper, there's too much information, but it isn't actually a new thing, even though it feels like it. And I started writing on I think first of all it was electric typewriter, then moved on to a word processor, and now of course being able to write and have the benefit of having a computer and instant research, it's just amazing. So I think that is the thing that, you know, as a writer, that's the thing that you really have to keep up with.
Oh,
because
sure.
Because the developments are so much faster these days.
But I think having laptops and word processors means a lot more people turn their hand to writing, don't they?
Oh, they do, yes.
Because when it, like you say, when it was laborious handwritten stuff, which you can't really imagine to going back to that now,
not
can
anymore.
You? It's really, it seems like another lifetime ago, but it wasn't. It was within living memory.
Well, it was.
All the laborious, you know, the old-fashioned typewriter with the ribbon,
yes.
And the carbon paper.
Had to press hard on the
keys. Can you imagine?
Yes. Yeah. Push back the key with the return each time.
Yeah, and then the ribbon would break or run out of ink. Yeah, so
and then you made a mistake, of course, and then you had to somehow, you know, alter it, rub it out, put the letter in exactly the same. You know.
Oh, gosh, yes, do you remember?
It's hopeless.
Stabbing away with that key.
Oh, dear.
But, yeah, so now everybody thinks that they can write. Like, we all think we can take photos because we've all got fabulous cameras on our phones,
yes,
haven't we?
And
we all think we're David Bailey now, don't we?
All this digital, you know, development. It's all think of ourselves as different people, hasn't it, really?
Yes.
Lots of ways.
Yes, it's made us sort of semi-experts in a lot of things.
I mean, when I wrote my first book, it was on, you know, on a typewriter. So you had all these
pages.
How
long did that take you, Jan?
Oh, it's really hard to tell.
I'm just thinking of that.
Well, it's not only the writing, of course, it's them finding someone who wants to read it.
Well, there is that. I just meant the actual physical typing it up, I suppose. Were you a 100-word-a-minute girl?
No, nothing like that. I did type, you know, sort of when I was working,
yes.
But no, I was never very accurate either, so I was always having to correct it all the time. But then having actually finally got this weighty sort of tome of paper, you have then to package it up, send it somewhere with a letter explaining what it is, and then you get a reply saying thank you, no, but no thank you. So you have to send it off to somewhere else. You only ever sent something to one person at a time because it was considered really bad manners to send something to more than one publisher. Mm. I don't know how many years it took, several years before finally I actually found somebody who wanted to publish what I'd written. And then, of course, there's another wait for probably about 18 months before that actually happens. And finally, a book appears.
Yes.
You think this is wonderful, you know.
It is wonderful.
Well, it is, really. I'm still embarrassed to think that I rushed off to look in the Sunday papers to see if it had been reviewed or not.
Oh, Jan, bless you. And had it?
Of course not, no.
Oh, that's lovely. It's a lovely story. But now, of course, you know, when you put your books up on Amazon, people do review all the time, don't they?
Well, they do, yes.
So you go back and there's somebody's left another...
Yes.
Another comment there. Yeah.
But I think it was quite nice to think that, you know, some literary expert might have reviewed it in the newspapers.
Well, of course. Yes. Yeah, that would be the aim. Yeah.
But no. Well, funny enough, I did get a review for the Animal Grace book that I mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
And that was in The Independent. And it was really rather nice because he said this was either a sort of joke or this was going to become a classic. And I don't think it's become a classic, so it must have been a joke.
No. I think it's a beautiful book. It's a really lovely idea, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
I can remember seeing one of the dogs. He was the constant companion of a bare-knuckle fighter in Highgate Cemetery, you know, the big Gothic cemetery.
Right, yes.
And he'd just... You know, one of those dogs that had lain with his master when he died, and they found him by the body. And he had, you know, the beautiful, on top of the tomb, there was the dog laying there, you know, beautifully.
Yes.
And it was just so moving, you know, this lovely dog, loyal to the last.
Yes.
It was just,
Of course, the great loyal dog was the Greyfriars Bobby in Edinburgh, who his master worked at the cemetery, and when his master died... he stayed on the grave. He was there for 14 years.
Goodness.
And, I mean, people, you know, obviously took an interest in him, and somebody bought him a licence because, of course, he had dog licences then, and people fed him, but he wouldn't leave the grave and he stayed there until he died.
Oh, my goodness.
And that's the sort of loyalty that just is, you know...
Yes, that's going back to what you were saying about that bond between animals and humans, isn't it?
Yes.
And if... You know, I appreciate not everybody likes animals, but it is, if you can feel that, they're like little souls, aren't they?
Yes.
And they,
yes.
they feed your
soul, don't, when you're feeling a bit low.
Yeah, it's that, you know, they don't judge you. They're, no, they're just,
you know, always there for you. And
not necessarily obedient. That's a different thing.
No, that would be asking way too much. Yeah. And I think our, you know, our little cat Daisy, she knows if we need cheering up, you know, and she almost puts on a little show for you, which is really sweet. And she does actually, she does dance, and she gets in, you know, if there's a birthday, she obliges you by getting in and out the boxes and the bags and playing with the ribbon. And, you know, it's just adorable. Yes, yeah, it's really lovely.
Yeah, they are just part of your family, aren't
yes.
they?
Oh, yes. Very much so. Yes. Very much so. Yeah. It's, yes, I'm not sure, you know, I say everybody thinks they're writing a cassette, but I never learnt to type. So I couldn't have typed a book if I tried. No, I mean, I'd handwritten it. But thank goodness for me, for the word processor.
Yes.
I mean, when I was little, I couldn't even spell, let alone write, Jan. I was absolutely hopeless. My mother had to write my essays for me when I was about 5. And I went to an all-girls convent school, if you can imagine that. And I was absolutely rubbish. You know, I had no idea about the academic side of life whatsoever. And my mum, bless her, used to sort of cover for me and write these stories, which I suppose because she shouldn't have done. You know, I should have been exposed for the idiot I was and probably had a bit more help at school. But she used to send me in with these tales, and I think, well, it's pretty obvious that I haven't written this composition. But gradually, by her doing that, I learned how to do it. You know, I thought, oh, I see well, what she's done
yes,
there.
Yeah,
yes. So just kind of, and she'd make me write them all out. So that was her kind of way of teaching me, I think, which was, I'll be ever grateful to her.
Well, she would be proud of you now.
Yes, I mean, she is. She comes to a lot of my spoken words yes. and sits there, and they make a real fuss of her. And she laps it up.
Yeah,
you
that's
know,
good.
She really Excellent. Does. Yeah, she milks it. So I think that's great. But they treat her like a little pet. They stroke her.
You know, well, you have to, you see, as you get old, you have to be treated in a
yes.
special way, don't you?
Yes, but she's 90 this year, and she's tiny. She's like a little kitten. So they make her, you know, they give her a cuddle and yeah, chat to her. So she adores it. But I've written, one of my books is called The Things You Miss While You're Away, which is a sort of about my childhood in the 60s and my daughter Sophie's in the 90s. And there's one little bit I've written about why I write. And I, like you, you know, I write because I love it and because you want to and need to tell the stories. But my main motivation after my poor mum went to hell and back to teach me how to spell, I felt it was the least I could do. So I just read this little bit. It's called Not the Best Days of My Life. The best part of any school day for me was home time. How I loved the sound of that bell at 3:30. Spending the day away from mum with a bunch of nuns with odd habits was bad enough. Having to waste evenings and weekends doing homework was a downright liberty. I hated spelling. Never had a strip of 10 three-letter words evoke such misery. I tried to learn them, I really did. The trouble was, I thought learn meant to have a quick look over before nipping out to play. I dreaded those Monday morning tests, sat at my desk surrounded by 20 brain boxes all with their pencils smugly poised. Standing at the front of the class, Sister Mary Frances looked as immaculate as the baby Jesus' conception. I was mesmerised by her wimple. "Does your head bleed when you stick those pins in it?" I asked. "No, it most certainly does not." "Oh, it's a miracle," I declared. She responded with a look that could kill. I was shocked, given it was at odds with the Sixth Commandment. She started the spelling test, slowly reading out each word. But no matter how careful her pronunciation, my brain couldn't conjure up the letters, let alone put them in the right order. But I did my best. What more could Sister Mary Frances ask? Quite a lot, judging by the glare she gave me after break. While I'd been busy pretending to be a horse and racing the length of the playground, she'd been inside marking our work. Once again, I elicited a reaction that had to be in conflict with her Christian beliefs. 0 out of 10 again, Joan Ellis. You are a stupid girl. Her mouth twitched with annoyance as she nodded at the piece of paper on my desk. 10 wrong spellings, 10 red crosses, and judging by that expression, they weren't kisses. I smirked, possibly not the smartest move I could have made. Her eyes bulged, fearing I'd turn into a pillar of salt just by looking at her. I stared down at my shoes. "Look at me. Your work is on your desk, not under it." Not wanting to lose face, I shouted defiantly, "My mummy says you don't know how to teach." It was true. Mum had uttered those fateful words when I'd returned home with yet another 0 scrawled across my work. But in fairness, she'd never intended her comment for broadcast. 20 little pairs of eyes stared at me, all waiting for the hand of God to strike me down. Luckily, he spared me. To thank him, I said a quick Hail Mary and vowed to give my pocket money to charity. Too late. The nun smote me down. Mother Bernadette will want to see your mother after school tomorrow, Joan Ellis. Be sure to tell her. I went home, ate 3 jam tarts and said nothing. Next morning in assembly, I sang the hymn and hoped it would prove my salvation. O Jesus, I have promised to serve thee to the end. Be thou forever near me, my master and my friend. I needed all the allies I could get against Sister Mary Frances. Joan Ellis, don't forget I shall see your mother after school today, announced Mother Bernadette. Sister Mary Frances looked smug and I wet myself.
Oh dear.
You can't imagine that kind of going on in schools nowadays,
gosh,
can you? Because
no.
Everything is so, that was the 60s, I think it was a long time ago. Mm. And it was very strict. I don't know about your school, but the discipline, it was all about speak when you're spoken to. We even had a silence card in the that they used to put up in the when we had our lunch in the lunch hall.
Really?
Can you imagine that?
Oh, gosh, no. It sounds like the refectory in a... Is that in a convent?
Yes, yeah. And yes. I think now they're very focused. It's all about the children, isn't it? It's all about creativity.
Oh, much more so.
Children being allowed to express themselves.
Yes.
And you hear the bell, and if you live next to a school, you just hear that cry go up, don't you, at lunchtimes, and you know they're on their break. Whereas we were just sort of penned in and not... Yeah.
There have been lots of progress in...
Yes, indeed. And that's got to be good, hasn't
it? Yes, it has indeed.
Because, we were really ruled by fear.
Yes.
I think we learned a lot, but I don't know. I think there are far better ways to do it. And my mum, in the end of that story, she was summoned, God bless her, and she turned up because I hadn't told her. So I just had to sort of haul her in that night when she came to collect me at 3:30 from school. And she just turned up like she normally would, in her stilettos, fur coat, bear in mind it was the 60s, some Mary Quant silver eyeshadow, bright red lipstick. I mean, honest to God, I nearly dropped dead. And, she sat and I told, I gave her the good news that she'd been summoned up to the head's office. And she just literally took it in a stride. She sashayed in, came out looking a bit, fractious and a bit nervous, saying, I think she said, oh my God, I should never have done that. You'll never get to play the Virgin Mary now and the Nativity. I was like, no, probably not, Mum. But having said that, I said to her, what did you tell them? And she said, oh, I just said, children like to learn through play. And that's the big thing that they say nowadays,
yeah,
isn't it?
It is indeed, yes.
But bless her. And then, we went in the following Monday and they'd taken on board her comments, which was quite surprising.
My
because we
goodness.
Were that old-fashioned, no sort of stimulation at all, bare walls, just rows and rows of desks, rows and rows of chairs and the teacher at the front. And then we went in and there was all this sort of beautiful, colourful, creative stuff all around that they'd put up.
Oh my
it was,
goodness.
Yeah, they'd really
That's quite a revolution,
to,
isn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah, and, because Mum... obviously, like I say, she's 90 this year. And she said, well, she said, I've never really had an education because she, came through and the war sort of cut everything short. So she's never had really a lot of confidence in her opinions or anybody taking too much notice of what she said. But I think, well, they did then.
So. She obviously said the right thing.
Yeah, so good for you. So I know you've got some other great stuff, haven't you? You've got stuff about bare-knuckle fighters and... All manner of books
yes,
you've written,
Jen. Yes, I've got an online book about an 18th century bare-knuckle boxer.
Do they still do that now? I mean, just talking about keeping up with the times. Can you still go and watch a bare-knuckle fight somewhere?
Not legally.
No,
so it's like dog fighting, It's, and sadly these things happen, but then they're not they're not actually legal.
No, okay. So this guy was when? When
He was born in about 17... I've now forgotten the dates because my memory's terrible. He died in 1812, I know that, and he was 33, and he drank himself to death because he'd... He had such a tragedy. He was world champion, and he was just literally on top of the world. This would have been his life ambition to become the world champion. Well, British wouldn't mean that. It was the national champion boxer. He achieved it, and shortly afterwards, he was just playing a game of fives with some friends, and the ball hit him in the eye and took his eye out.
Oh gosh!
And that from that point on was, of course, he couldn't see well enough.
Well, yeah,
to
that
be able
would be
to fight
pretty,
at that sort of level.
Pretty essential, yeah.
And he just couldn't cope with the fact that he couldn't defend his championship. And so he was, like all these boxers of those times, they retired and ran a pub. Of course, the idea was that people would come in and they would regale them with stories of their glory days. But he just drank himself to death. And it just seems, such a waste of this bright young man. Who yeah.
So did he? How long did his career, if you want to call it career?
His boxing career lasted, probably over 5 or 6 years.
And how many fights a week would he be having, do you think?
I'm not so sure a week. But again, actually, it was illegal then as well. Mm. And so newspapers would carry a sign saying, there is going to be an event somewhere 14 miles south of London. And anyone in the know would know that 14 miles south of London meant a certain, Wimbledon or some specific place, and in the hope that the authorities wouldn't find out. But of course, invariably they did, and they would come along just at the right moment and stop the fight. And it's quite a brave thing to do when all these people have got themselves ready. I mean, I must say that I'm horrified by boxing. I think physical violence of any sort, but there was just something about this particular man that was I found very attractive. And he was taken up by people like Lord Byron, Dukes, the King's son, the Duke of Cumberland. He was, one of his
fans. Do you mean like a fan?
Yes, but also, of course, they spent money on him.
Yes.
They raised him up, they bought him property and all these things. Oh. So, of course, his expectations...
So he was a bit of a celebrity.
Well, he was, yes. They say he was more famous than
David
Napoleon
Beckham.
He's certainly more famous than Wellington at the time.
Early Beckham.
And so, of course, then he had so much more to lose than other people. So
so he was just a natural. He was just born
with
this skill.
Yes, he was. One of those people who just wanted to fight.
And what about, did he have any, you say he lost an eye, but did he have any other kind of like brain injuries or any, did he ever suffer anything?
Well, it's always hard to tell, isn't it? The fights would last for hours.
Really?
It's absolutely horrendous.
Did they have a set number of rounds, or was it just death, but to
They fought a round, and the round stopped when one or the other of them would actually go down on one knee because he'd either been hit and he just needed breathing space. And then they just start again after 30 seconds. And sometimes it was 70 or 80 rounds and perhaps 3 or 4 hours of constant battering each other until one of them in the end just fell over. So it was ruthless.
So it was more or less to the death.
Horrible thing.
It was
really
to the death. So one of them could no longer carry on. They would just they would just go until that point.
Yes, they would, yes. I mean, to give up would have been considered...
Yes.
You
know. So it was very almost gladiatorial, wasn't it?
It was, yes, very much so, yes.
And did they have a referee or...?
They did. They had the equivalent of seconds, but one of them was actually the stall man because, of course, they didn't have benches in there. So one of the two men who helped them would go down and have one knee ready so the boxer could sit on his knee during the 30 seconds.
I'd rather like that.
But so I wrote a book called Alas Poor Jem, because the man was called Jem Belcher, but it's an ebook. It's not that you can't
you can get it on Kindle
but you can't get it any other way. No,
well, a lot of people, that's how they access their books these days.
Yes,
isn't it?
Yes, so I enjoyed writing it anyway.
And do you know, have you had a lot of feedback from that, from the audience that enjoy that sort of thing? Have you had any comments back?
Not a lot, really. I think this is another thing that writers discover, that you put up your e-book, but while you're putting your e-book up, probably 20, 30, 40 people are doing it just at the same moment.
Absolutely.
So there are literally thousands of books out there any time to choose from, and it's really... it's hopeless to think that you're going to make a lot of money from putting up an electronic book online, because it just doesn't happen.
No, definitely not. And you think, it's I don't know how long it takes you to write a book, but me, it's usually about a year.
Yes.
And I know people can write them a lot quicker and do churn them out a lot quicker.
I did write that one probably in about 6 months because I just got the idea, had the information and, you know, dashed it off, really.
But you put in 6 months, a year's work.
Yes,
but then you're selling them for usually 99p, aren't you?
Exactly,
or often giving them away for free on there.
Crazy, crazy world.
Yeah.
Yes.
But at least now that we've got that, we're able to put our work out there, which is fantastic,
and
isn't it?
You know, there's no reason why people shouldn't have the pleasure of putting their books out there for other people to read. But it's not quite the same as, you know, getting a publisher who likes it enough.
Yeah, but I think people now, they just don't care. I think they consume books in a very different way.
Yes, and people read a lot these
they
days.
Do. Are they do.
More than they ever did, I think.
I think they're absolutely true, Jan. I think either they do that and they read, you know, very keen, avid readers and just consume books, much the way as, you know, we consume everything else these days. Or they don't read at all because they simply don't have time.
No.
You know, that's what a lot of people tell me at signings and things.
Yeah, so ironically, I find I don't really have time to read very much.
Well, you're too busy writing. You're too busy writing to read anything. Yeah. So what's next in you? Because I know you are such a prolific writer. So anything next on your pipeline?
Yeah, I've been writing. I discovered that I like writing fiction. And I wrote a book called The Accidental Assassin. And much to my amazement, I mean, it's published and someone has taken a film option on it.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Now, I don't think this will, you know, happen quickly because it's always that question of, you know, it's a small film company and they've got to raise the funds actually to do it. But the fact that someone's interested in doing it is wonderful.
Of course it is. Congratulations. That's a real feather in your cap. And I love the cover of that book. It's got a poodle on the front, hasn't it?
Right.
It's just brilliant. You see it and you think, what's this all about?
Yeah. But I think I've actually got into writing humour now, and I didn't, because I never thought of myself as writing, you know, comedy. And so I'm writing a book about a fictional village somewhere in England called Never Fondle.
Where's this going, Jan?
And the people, well, yes, that's it. I'm aware that your time is running out. I've got a brief extract here. I don't know whether you want me to read it or whether there's not quite time.
I don't think we've got time this time, but we'd love you to come back and hear more about Never Fondle.
Never Fondle,
yes. The nether regions of Never Fondle.
Yeah,
it's probably a really good place to stop there, Jan, because I think...
Yes, don't go any further.
No, don't go any further. Well, it's been such a joy talking to you. Really loved
it. It's been a pleasure for me.
Every second. Thank you so much for making the journey in. And I hope you've enjoyed listening. Next week I'm going to be here again talking to island poet Dom Curran, and he is a young guy with a lot to say, very intelligent poetry and some very wise words, and I think you're going to really enjoy that. So please tune in again next Friday at 1. Okay, take care, have a lovely weekend. Bye bye.